Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. Good to have you all with us here. We're about to have another kind of conversation episode of What Would You Do If You Were Mayor? We are joined by all our guests are on by phone today, because one of the questions you might ask if you were mayor, how would you get the streets plowed if you were mayor of Baltimore? That's a good question. Jacqueline Rabarge is with us. Jacqueline Rabarge is founder and director of Power Inside, a program of fusion partnerships. Jessica Lewis is with us, housing organizer at the Right to Housing Alliance and a current OSI fellow. And Dr. John Bullock joins us once again, professor of political science at Towson University. And Jackie, Jessica, and John, welcome. Good to have all of you with us.
Hey, thank you, Mark. Good to be here.
410-319-8888 is the number to join us. You can write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook page and see if you've written there. Tweet us at Mark Steiner, but call in. 410-319-8888. What would you do if you were mayor? So this, very quickly, I mean, I remember I drove in this morning and coming down Perrin Parkway, and the county roads, at least in that part of the county, were clean. In other parts, they weren't. As soon as I hit Perrin Parkway in the city, it was like nothing had happened. And then all the people coming in to do the morning show here at WEA said coming in from the city as well, nothing had happened. So, John Bullock, how would you get the plows running? How are your roads doing?
You know, actually, the roads over here aren't all that great. It's probably why I'm on the phone right now. There are a couple of ways to look at it. One is really just having a game plan set ahead. So we know that, okay, there's a forecast ahead. Can we make sure that we get those plows out early in the morning and also salting and sanding the roads? There's also ideas about having individual contractors also do plowing. So if we have people in different quadrants of the city who have access to vehicles, that they can also plow some of those small streets that oftentimes don't get plowed and wind up getting iced over for days.
Jackie, I know this is not necessarily your bailiwick, but you'd have to deal with it if you were mayor.
Hi, Mark. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can.
Oh, I'm so sorry. All right. Wow, that is not a question I was prepared for. I got three pages of notes, and that is not one thing that is my expertise. You know, I grew up in northern New York, which the temperature right now is 35 below. They are always prepared for emergencies and inclement weather. And so I guess, you know, one thing I would be thinking about is how can we always be prepared, because there's always something falling outside the box. And so I really, you know, in this kind of diminished capacity in responding to emergencies, I'm not really sure what we would do except tell everyone to stay home.
Right. I mean, exactly. But it's true. And you all did stay home.
We did. We know what's up.
So, folks, if you're staying home, join us at 410-319-8888. And join us with your own weather stories and your unplowed streets and how you're feeling about that and more. Just what you would do if you were mayor of this city of Baltimore. 410-319-8888. What would be your priorities? One of the things clearly in the news right now that's really grabbed everybody, we talked a bit about yesterday on our roundup of the year's news and looking ahead at this year, is the city murder rate. And also the controversy over the response by Commissioner Batts, who was basically saying that everyday people don't have to worry about it because these are – and he wasn't diminishing the deaths, which some people said he did. He was not diminishing the deaths of people who died. But it was saying that they, most of them were African Americans who died from the drug wars and the drug trade, that were kind of bottled up in certain neighborhoods. But that is also kind of assuming, Jackie, that people in certain neighborhoods, even if they're not involved, who are not involved in the drug trade, who don't carry guns, who don't have weapons, are not affected by this crisis of violence.
Yeah, absolutely, Mark. I mean, the culture of violence impacts everyone in the city. And, you know, there isn't a community that's not touched by these murders. And one of the things that I would hopefully address as mayor is really looking at how deep and historical the trauma goes with the violence, the poverty, and the unemployment. And Sherrilyn Ifill had it right in her op-ed that really we should not discount those victims who had a criminal record. And, you know, over the years, we always see this. Every murder, they always talk about the criminal background of the individual. It's not a criminal background in Baltimore City. And so, you know, I would like us to stop focusing on or minimizing the deaths by talking about their criminal record and start talking about the intergenerational violence and intergenerational trauma that gives rise to this. And then I also would think about how do we better protect victims and witnesses. We hear a lot of information about how victims are handled, and people are afraid. People are afraid to come forward, and people are traumatized. And, you know, honestly, I was in a court process where I was recently a victim. Someone broke into our house, and we had to spend many months in two different court processes. One is for a juvenile case, one is an adult case. And, you know, even as empowered as myself, really felt not well-treated in the system on all accounts. And I think that's part of what we need to do for people to come forward on the different, on the violent crimes. We need that to happen.
John?
You know, when I think about the murder rate, I would approach it from two ways. I mean, one is from an enforcement way, which is really, you know, it's been talked about before, legalization in some ways. What you do with that is you reduce the black market element, you release the violent element that exists with the drug trade. We know that it's existed not only in this city, but in many cities across this entire country. This is for so long, and the drug war has been unsuccessful. It keeps on going. So there's a need to really change how we police the issue, but also to take away that violent element. But the other piece that I would add to it would really be, what do we do with young people, or even not so young people? I mean, I think there, you know, we tend to devalue some of our young people as opposed to investing in them. And so one of the things I would really look for is a real structured mentoring program. You know, one of the people in the city I'd like to, you know, really give a shout out to is really, you know, Cameron Miles, and he has a program, you know, mentoring male teens in the hood. And I was able to talk to some of those young people a couple weeks ago, and it's great being able to talk to young people from, you know, 7 years old to 17 years old and tell them about some of the realities of this. But oftentimes these things happen in little pockets around the cities. We know that there are people who oftentimes have a challenged family structure or live in neighborhoods that are challenged, but we need to invest in those people rather than just writing them off. So again, I would say it from a legal aspect, how we enforce the laws, but then also how we invest in some of these people in our city.
Well, let me take both these things for a minute. And folks, do join us here, 410-319-8888. Write to us here, steinershow@gmail.com. I really want to hear your thoughts on this. This is a really very critical issue, I think, for the city, and it's hard for most cities in many places to put their hands around this. The city's murder rates have gone down. People have all kinds of discussion arguments why, and that sometimes people argue that it's out of the hands of those in authority to really do anything about it. This is the ebb and flow. Maybe that's absolutely insane. But what do you think? 410-319-8888. We have an email coming in, which we'll read here in just a moment. But your thoughts, steinershow@gmail.com, 410-319-8888. So we have a problem with the issue of murders in our community. And I was just reading on The Root this morning about a young woman in another city who was gunned down for no reason at all as she was putting her baby in her car, picking her up from the babysitter, and wasn't involved in anything. And so there's several levels of issues here. One has to do with people who are involved in violence in our communities and how you address that, because many people in Baltimore are scared. They're scared of moving from place to place, of getting kids from school to home. The kind of aura of violence, the sense of violence is around them. So what do you do about that? I mean, this is, you know, it's one thing to say that you look at young people who are blown away and shot and killed in this city that are much too young to die. But what do we do to prevent that? And what do we do to have our communities feeling like they're safe? Where do you invest the money and how? I mean, I really want to get some concrete ideas. What would you do, Jackie?
So one of the things, you know, they always talk about focusing on the most violent gun offenders, but you know, the reality is we're still incarcerating and putting resources into arresting very low-level offenders, especially homeless folks and people with mental illness and drug addiction. So really, to divert some of the resources from criminalizing homelessness, especially for those sleeping in city-owned abandoned houses, would really free up some resources to investigate crimes. The other thing I think is important is, you know, this broad brush of everyone's a criminal. Everyone feels like they might be targeted at one point or another, really has made folks not trust the police. And so they're not even reporting violent crimes that happen to them. So we have many, many more victims out there of violent crimes than are actually reporting them. And so the level of trust needs to be increased. And the only way that can happen is through some police accountability and some measures, some concrete measures put in place to increase that trust.
So how do you do that? Let's tackle what you were saying, man, before we go back to John Bullock's ideas. I mean, how do you do that?
One of the things that I would like to see is a civilian review board or some outside process to look into police-involved injuries, police-involved deaths. Wisconsin, the state of Wisconsin has a very innovative bill working through their legislative process to automatically institute an outside review when there is a police-involved death. I would like to see that expanded into the injuries and complaints so that we have a process. We don't have a robust process to look into the times when the police are not doing the right thing. And I think that is not the majority of cases, but that is why people are not having trust in the system. And then the other thing, I think we really should look at what's right in front of us. So we talked a lot about the Baltimore City Detention Center. That one facility releases 39,000 people per year, or 100 per day. And they're getting out between 5 p.m. and 6 a.m. So on a night like last night, when the temperatures were down in the single digits, people are walking out of the detention center with no place to go, most of them very low-level offenders. And so our lack of care or concern for those individuals, what really do they have to look forward to? And so we have the numbers and the data that shows who those folks are, where they go, what neighborhoods they come from. Why are we not addressing the jail reentry issue like it is the crisis that it actually is?
John, jump in on that.
You know, I would agree with a lot of what was said and even add a couple things. So when I think about diversion programs, it also makes you think about some of the court-mandated service. And oftentimes, it tends to be low-level. You do a couple hours or do the hours you need, and you're done. But I would like to see a program where we're getting, you know, people, whether they're young, middle-aged, whatever, into meaningful community service projects. I mean, this not only, you know, is good for the city in terms of, you know, cleaning and greening and helping some of the neighborhoods where people come from that happen to be very disinvested, but part of it is getting people to really have a pride in place, pride in their neighborhoods, but also investing in themselves and their neighborhoods. So what if we can have apprenticeship programs that are connected with some of the green economy, getting people to rehab homes, getting people to, you know, to do energy efficiency audits, to do planting, to do to mow lawns, to clean up trash, all those kinds of things. Because I think about the example from the Turk House, right, which is a drug rehabilitation center here in West Baltimore. And one of the things that they had an open doors program where you see, men who had been offenders for years. And it was interesting hearing them talk about, you know, I was here and I helped, destroy the community, and now I'm here to help rebuild it. And they and really, you know, demonstrating, you know, the link between, you know, your activities and what happens in the community. You talked about this, you know, about people being hurt, you know, and killed, you know, just moving from one place to another. And it's about the value of life, you know, that it touches all of us. We can't really just write it off and say that's just one community's problem, one group's problem, because it winds up touching us all. When you think about people who are involved in, you know, the criminal lifestyle, a lot of it comes from a lack of opportunities. And so we can beef up, you know, job opportunities for folk in the city, apprenticeship, you know, programs. You know, one of the things that I was thinking about when you originally, you know, when we talked about, you know, the segment, I was thinking about the residency requirement for government workers. I mean, you look at so many people who have jobs in Baltimore City, and a lot of them don't live in the city. And so at the same time, we have so many people who are out of work. We also have a diminished tax base. So I would also connect it to an employment program as well.
So, I mean, I'm going to open the phone to you, but I want to come back. I have some very specific questions about the things that you both raised, and I mean, how any of these things get implemented, and what a mayor is to do when when the mayor is stuck between a police department and also the needs of a community, and how you make and how you build that bridge and make that work. I think that's always been part of the problem we've had here. And I think that, Jackie, you're absolutely right about the city detention center. If you look at what's going on in Wisconsin now, which we'll be talking about in the show over the next couple of weeks, they're introducing a bill in the legislature, not an anti-police bill, but a bill on police accountability, which is very different. And we can talk a bit about that. But your thoughts at 410-319-8888. Deborah, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning, Deborah.
In terms of the what the mayor can do as far as the crime and things that is concerned, in my opinion, what we're failing to do is addressing the problem from a family perspective. The individual come back from the system, come back into the community, come back to the family, but no one in the family, even the person who's being released, knows how to address the issues in terms of hoping that this person doesn't go back by committing some of the same things that he did and to put him there in the first place. The mayor, somehow or another, should be a family program. And when I say family, I just don't mean the immediate family. I'm talking about extended family to ensure that that individual don't get caught up again in the same madness that's out there in the street. And we don't do that. We just put him out there, and he goes back to wherever or whoever that would receive them, and so, it's not a connection there with the family. I mean, aunt, uncle, grandparents, everything, to ensure that this person don't go back into the same environment.
Well, Deborah, very quick before we go to break here, and we have about a minute till we have to go to break. I mean, how would you do that?
Well, that's the question. How would we do that? Well, first of all, we got to realize that we need to do it. And how we do it, we need to sit down, a task force or something, to come devise some ideas in terms of involving the family. Get some of those individuals who returned back home and get them in their families, in the total family, not an agency, not something that they built up, a social worker, something. No, that's
right.
Not the family. It should be some feelings and emotions and things that's there to find out why that person went that way in the first place. And then the family need to get together, and that is where the program should address the family, the total family. Because you know what? If it's not there, he's going to go back out into the street, he or she, if it's not there. And I'm talking about his immediate family.
So we're going to take a very brief break, Deborah, and wrestle with what you just said when we come back from this break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We are here with Jackie Rabarge, founder and director of Power Inside, a program of fusion partnerships, and Dr. John Bullock, professor of political science at Taos University, talking about what would you do if you were the mayor? 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. A lot of people are calling in, so when I get to their calls, Lester, you're the next caller up. So let's respond to what we heard Deborah just say. Jackie, and kind of also round that out with how you think the things even you talked about and what Deborah's talking about can be implemented, given what people say is a budget crisis and no funds.
Well, you know, I love Deborah because she very astutely said that
what we first need to do is realize that we need to change. And when we're working with drug addicted people in Baltimore, people in a change process start out with first trying to recognize there's a problem. And I think in a lot of ways, we have not done that as a city. Some of the issues should be a state of emergency. The health disparities, the mortality rates driven by race and poverty, the homelessness where we permit people to sleep outdoors or on a sidewalk, these things do not rise to the level of concern that they should. And so, you know, while there are a lot of policy measures that can be put in place or being used in other cities, I'm concerned that we don't even think it's troubling that we have 3,000 people who could potentially be on the streets with too few shelter beds. So we put in place a 10-year plan to end homelessness, but right in front of us is the despair and the lack of human rights that would really bring us to a call to action. And so we're kind of running here and there trying to create, you know, patch holes in the dike when it really is a much bigger problem. But, you know, having said that, I think the composites of data, I mean, look, we've got Johns Hopkins University who's given a tremendous amount of data about what's happening inside of our own city. Why are we not taking those composites of data to look at why things are the way they are and then move into some best practice solutions, as Deborah had said, that we really need to take a look at what's going on. The other thing I think is there are a lot of wonderful things happening in communities that are not getting the attention, the resources, and the political play that they need. There are people. I was walking down 25th Street and saw a woman distributing food from her front porch. And I asked her, you know, what auspices she was doing this under. It was just what she was doing because she knew there were hungry people in the community. And people, and, you know, there are things happening all around the city where people under-resourced are actually trying to make a difference. And I, you know, I'd really like to look to the community for those solutions and have, you know, listening session after listening session and people from city government out into the community finding out what is already being done and how can we resource those after-school programs that are set up on an impromptu basis, those churches that are setting up food pantries on their own, you know, with just their congregation support, and trying to lift up some of those initiatives. And Cameron Miles' initiative, I mean, I've known him for many years, things like that where people are really putting in effort but don't have the support of city government.
So I'm going to open the phones here and go get our next caller. And as we do, I just think about whether or not how you reallocate funds in a city like this to support people doing things on their own like that, that are really not given their due as serious as really having a serious effect because everything's done through the bureaucracy. Do you know what I'm saying? So I want to come to that question. 410-319-8888. Lester, you're on the air.
First of all, Happy New Year to everybody.
Happy New Year, Lester.
Happy New Year.
Yeah, I thought Jessica was going to be on the show. I was going to give a shout out to her specifically because the work she's doing on homelessness is incredibly important. But you know, I wanted to talk about quickly about two things. One is the snow issue. The snow issue is I think what the mayor should do a much better job, or if I were mayor, I would do a much better job connecting all these programs or all these problems to two issues. One is wealth inequality, and the other is climate change. So the problem with the snow issue is that there is that cities in general have like fixed budgets to deal with snow that's based on kind of an average of previous snow accumulation. One of the problems with climate change is that weather becomes erratic and you just don't know how much, you know, whether you're going to get slammed. So a few years ago, we got like, what, 60, 70 inches, something like that. And like the years before that maybe had added up to like 10 or 11, right? So the problem with this is that, so what I would do in this case is use the budget shortfall to talk about global climate change. That's what I would do on this issue, right? The other issue, the issue of crime, Dr. Bullock, who I also appreciate, I think he's right. I would start and end with legalization, though, right? I mean, because the mentorship programs he's talking about are really important, but what we're talking about is an economic problem, right? It's, again, you talk about wealth inequality. The reason that the murder rates are so connected to the drug trade is because the only way competing drug firms can get more profit is to basically kill each other because they have to take real estate and they can't go to the city and say, okay, we want to sell drugs here, right? So the mentorship programs are important, kind of, sort of, but they really don't. They, in general, what we need to be talking about is legalization, even if the climate isn't ripe for passing legalization. It's still important to at least say it out loud. This is legalization. And then to the extent you can tie that to wealth inequality, to also talk about the biggest addiction that the city has, which is to giving corporate subsidies. They're addicted to the belief that corporate quote-unquote citizens actually help cities rather than hurt them, right? So that's what I would do.
Lester, I love it. So John Bullock, respond to Lester.
Yeah, this is right on point. So it's echoing a lot of what I'm thinking. You know, again, we talk about legalization. Again, it's an argument that we're having across the country, and it's something that I think Baltimore's ripe for. You know, to take it to even the investment in the city as it relates to you know, to taxpayer funding for projects. What are the mechanisms that we could actually use to you know, to not discourage development, but to also connect some of those funds to neighborhood investment, is to really have a mechanism for neighborhood investment along these development projects. I think one of the great examples was something that was done in Washington, and again, there may be still some issues around the implementation of it, but when you have that national stadium being built and that you know, community groups pushed for having a neighborhood investment fund. So if there's going to be development for a stadium, there should also be investment in neighborhoods. And so that was, you know, to the total of about $1 billion. Now, whether they see that money, that's also something to be to keep our eye on. But for every dollar that's spent for development, especially if this is going to be taxpayer funded, there should also be a commensurate, you know, investment in neighborhoods. It may not be a dollar for dollar, it may be, you know, 2-to-1, but it needs to be some you know, investment, some serious investment into those neighborhoods. That money could be in an affordable housing trust fund, which right now is pretty meager as far as city's concerned. We could also beef up the community benefit agreements that should be attached to these type of projects. So again, we're not just saying we can't have development, but if you're going to have development, there should also be some investment into neighborhoods, and that could help support some of those programs, whether it be cleaning and greening or mentoring or anything like that that's happening in those neighborhoods, as well as development of housing.
One of the things I learned the other day, and we did a program here, and I mentioned the fact that we had a law in Baltimore City that was not enforced about having affordable housing attached to any development that takes place to town. But what I didn't realize, and I was corrected in a conversation I was having with somebody about this, was that if that is implemented, the city has to pay for it, not the developer. Therein lies the rub, Jackie. We don't have those things in place that could actually force that kind of change.
And some of this defies common sense, and so I've never been very good at politics for that reason. someone needs to explain to me why that is true. You know, I just read that the city pension money might be diverted to pay for development, and, you know, someone needs to explain to me why we would dip into someone's security, their economic security for the long term, to feed a corporate interest that probably could pay for the development themselves. I mean, I really think that's a real problem. And I think some of, you know, what could be a remedy to that is, you know, the transparency and information sharing in the city needs to be improved, to go beyond the cryptic database on Open Baltimore, where, you know, large spreadsheets are put up in ways that, you know, the everyday citizen can't understand. And, you know, so it feels like we get broadsided with these issues at the last minute. And it just really, again, I think this adds to the distrust of what's going on in government.
There was an email here. Let me see. I just had it a moment ago. Here we go. And then we'll go to our next caller, Chuck. I'll just read it very fast. Rhonda wrote in, if I were mayor of Baltimore, I'd replace the director of each agency. I would also hire qualified people that have not been fired from other states, and job experiences fits the description of the job. It is my hope that the current mayor will stop drowning the city and step aside. The problem is will be Jack Young becoming mayor, and there are serious concerns with his competency. In 5 years, if we luck up and have an honest mayor and city council, there will have to be charges filed for embezzlement. The strategy was to bring people that are not connected to the city in positions of authority. The salaries and jobs would end if they try to address the missing revenue and policies that are no longer available to the public. 410-319-8888. Chuck, you're on the air.
Hello?
You're on the air, Chuck.
Hello. Hi. Yeah, I was. I just turned the station on, and I heard they were asking, if you were mayor, what would you do? Well, if I was mayor, I'd tell you what, though, with the racial profiling that's going on in the court systems and everything, you look at the laws with that revolves around marijuana itself, and the reason it was made illegal in 1937 specifically pinpoints the black and Mexican communities. And the racist judge, Anslinger, actually admitted to it. I mean, you look at it, you make this plant that's been known medicinally for thousands of years illegal, and you got big pharma companies making big bucks. You look at the people that gave the bill to the judge, to the racist judge in 1937 on why they should make this plant illegal in the first place. Now you have innocent fathers that are arrested for having a plant in their basement that's been known by cancer.gov and doctors like Sanjay Gupta that's world-renowned to actually have medicinal benefit. But if you go on DEA.gov, quote-unquote justice.gov, it actually talks about marijuana being a Schedule One drug, which is the most dangerous, most addictive drug known to man with no medicinal benefit. Now, how many innocent fathers and uncles and brothers and sisters are locked up in jails and prisons for something federally illegal? You know, you got a government that also, if you go on CDC.gov, I heard everybody talking about the snow issues. You go on CDC.gov and look up cloud seeding, and you find out that the government actually modifies the weather with these chemtrails with silver iodide.
Chuck, we're almost out of time here in this segment, but I do want to rest with what you said, and we have another email to read here, and I think that the question, your marijuana question, is very serious. But let me conclude with this email and go back to our guests so they can also jump in here. Lauren writes in, I would prioritize housing authority and discretionary funds to create and maintain affordable housing rather than using these resources for vacant housing demolition. I would change the language in the inclusionary housing statute so that developers are required to set aside 15% to 20% of new housing for low-income families. I would recreate the Dollar House program and create employment programs by having people work on low-income construction. Jackie, John, closing thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, obviously housing is the one of the biggest needs in Baltimore. You know, the people getting released from jail, the recent report that the mayor has on her desk is that the biggest request is for housing and employment, and that's what folks getting out of jail think that they need to make a better life for themselves. And so we need to do that, and I think the funds are in the criminal justice system, in the prosecution of low-level offenders. We need to get them out of the system and divert those resources into the community solutions, employment, and the housing that they need.
John?
Just going back to the last caller in the email, you know, I agree, again, around the issue of how we deal with drugs as a public health issue as opposed to a law enforcement issue. And I think there's some sensible policies not only around the country but also around the world that we can look at that are more effective. I'm also glad that someone mentioned the Dollar House program. That's one of the things that I wanted to mention as well. I would not necessarily scrap the current vacant value program, but I would bring back that Dollar House program because as it sits right now, a lot of your, nonprofit or even smaller development firms, they're able to buy, blocks of houses and develop them. But the average, average Joe or Jane who wants to, take a house and do sweat equity, it's difficult for them to get in the game. So that Dollar House program, I think, will be very instrumental in helping that process move along.
Well, one of the things I should add to you about the dollar houses that many people I mean, we don't realize often, is that that was a federally funded program. That's where the money came from. That money dried up and the dollar houses dried up. And I think that that was part of that. But there are creative things you could do. I mean, the way other cities are doing housing banks, land banks, and really put make that a priority. I mean, there are when you look at the mayor of New York just sworn in, there are many people around the progressive world that are looking to de Blasio and see what he's gonna, what he can do in a city that is really controlled by financial interests and developers, even more intensely in ways, some ways than Baltimore is, and what how he can change things. I mean, that's part of the political battle, I think.
Right. No, I agree with you, Mark. I mean, I think money is definitely, you know, a big part of the issue and who controls, you know, the bank of the city. I mean, and even when you look at the Dollar House program, you know, you're right that the federal government provided a lot of the assistance in terms of, you know, some of the dollars that could help to, you know, to rehab the house. But there's nothing that precludes the city from actually, you know, dispensing of some of these properties at a cheaper value. But you're right. All the programs we've talked about today all require some financial investment. And the question is where to find those funds as well.
Well, this has been really a fascinating discussion as usual. And Jackie, just closing thought from you before we end up?
You know, Mark, I think I pretty much said it all. I think
okay.
We're going to need another show on this.
No, we will. And we're going to have you back a great deal because there's a lot we have to talk about in terms of the issues we've been talking about around Tyrone West and about the medical examiner's office that we've raised and other issues that I think really had to be pushed and the whole idea of police accountability, which people should not look at as an anti-police measure, but as a measure to kind of create a force closer to the community.
Absolutely. And there's some good people out there that, the officers are doing the best they can with what they've got, and we need to make sure that they have the resources to do their job and weed out the bad apples.
And all that's true. I mean, I have to say this in close with just that thought, because people sometimes think I will come out here and be anti-police. I'm not. Some of my closest friends are police. My nephew's a cop. One of my students have become police. This is about accountability and changing the way we do business in the city so that people cooperate and work with one another and abuse stops. I mean, that's all we're talking about. So I want to thank both of you for being with us. Dr. John Bullock, who's professor of political science at Towson University, Jackie Robarge, founder and director of Power Inside, a program of fusion partnerships. Thank you both for being with us here on What Would You Do If You Were Mayor?
Thanks for having me, Mark.
And thank you all for writing in and calling in to let us know what you would do if you were mayor. This will be a continuing segment on the show as you wrestle with the issues facing our community. Stay with us. We're going to take a very short break and come back and be joined by Sam Faddis, a retired CIA operations officer and author, talking about what's going on in Sochi, Russia right now and what he thinks is going on. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speak in their mind.